19 Uniform, thank you, descend flight level 110.
0, Shuttle 19 Uniform,
join 28 Romeo Yankee, we're climbing flight level 70 on the Otago departure.
Emirates 6 Oscar Bay, continue your right turn on navigation now to Dulles.
Blue Messenger for Victor Hotel, turn right heading 325.
Hello and welcome to For Flying Out Loud, a podcast that aims to inspire, empower and help all of our listeners to dream bigger. My name is Andrew Neofitu and I'm super happy to welcome you to another inspirational interview in season 2 of For Flying Out Loud. If you enjoy the episodes and you want them to keep coming, please consider showing your support and buy me a coffee. You can find a link in the episode description. Now, it's so easy to take a career in aviation for granted. There can't be many careers when you can have such a diverse range of experiences, from being a commercial pilot and getting to do things on people's bucket lists to having some epic adventures, just like I'm lucky enough to do, to just taking your mates flying. It's also a great place to make lifelong friends and acquaintances, and personally, I'm so incredibly grateful for that. I've known today's guest for 30 years now, and it's fascinating to see how our lives have diverged, yet we both still have that same fire and passion in our bellies for aviation as we always did. This episode of For Flying Out Loud is brought to you by Flight Deck Wingman, expert support to help you pass your airline or flight school selection process.
To be honest, for me, the move up to the master class from the challenger class has probably been different to most people's experience. For me, the pressures were actually reversed because my background, like the Red Arrows, where you know I led a team of 100 people and 13 aeroplanes. So I'm very much used to having that team structure around me. It just helps completely clear your mind of all the other distractions, which is exactly what you need for a sport like this. We know the aeroplane's working, we know the team's working. That confidence in the game plan is to be in the round of 8 every single race. And hopefully that final 4 places is a reality rather than just a dream.
He's a former Royal Air Force frontline fighter pilot who also served as leader of the Royal Air Force aerobatic team, the Red Arrows. Having hung up his Fastjet flying boots and swapped them for a pair of high-performance unlimited aerobatic flying shoes in 2013, in 2016 he took a massive leap of faith and entered the octane-fueled sport of air racing when he joined the thrilling world of the Red Bull Air Race in the Challenger Cup. In 2018, his performance saw him make a spectacularly rapid move to the masterclass of this elite sport. Today, it's a real pleasure to welcome air race pilot and my lifelong aviation friend, Ben Murphy, to the podcast. Ben, a very warm welcome to For Flying Out Loud.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Ben. Ben, I want to, obviously I've said we're lifelong friends there, friends sort of come and go in terms of seeing each other regularly, but we've been in touch one way or another for the last, makes me want to throw up, I think it's about 30 years. It's 30 years this year.
It is quite scary, isn't it? Yeah, I think our paths first crossed, didn't they, on a flying scholarship at Tollerton in Nottingham, and when we were very young and fresh-faced, but yes, a lot of flying water has passed under the bridge since then.
It has 1992 in a PA-38 Tomahawk. And do you know, I remember this story, I think we chatted about it before we did this recording today, of my instructor, Tony Morton, and I can't remember what yours was called. Was it called Les or something
like that?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah. It was Les.
Yeah.
And I remember Les and my instructor having this chat going, he's really quite good, he's really quite good. And I was thinking, back of the net, I'm really quite good. And they're like, no, it's Ben. I was like, I was gutted. That's how it started.
and the competitive banter has been going ever since, hasn't it? Yeah.
But so PA-38, Tom, I've got some cheesy photos I might have to find somewhere, dig them out, ask for your approval, maybe put them alongside the podcast of you and me sat somewhere in 1992.
I think mine remain firmly locked away.
But fast forward about 10 years and I seem to remember bumping into you in the corridor of 899 Squadron, which was a Sea Harrier OCU, and I hadn't seen you in about 10 years, and it's amazing. It seemed like a long time at that time, but 10 years now we know is like it's a heartbeat, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. I was down there doing ramp training, wasn't I, to in the Harrier GR7 prior to deploying on the boat, as we call it. Do you know what, mate? I think that's the beauty of aviation, though. It starts off like that. And if you remember, there were some other guys on our flying scholarship course, and I've had exactly the same. You know, some have been airline pilots, others have either stayed in the aviation world, and I think that's the beauty of it. And yeah, especially in the military, you can just pick up a friendship where you left it 5-10 years ago, yeah. And it's like literally like nothing's changed. Like we're back in that crew room as young snotty nosed 17-year-old kids. Yeah, yeah, nothing changes.
Yeah. 100%. And you on a GR7-8 obviously then became a GR9. Can you talk to me a bit more about that time, Ben, and sort of the highs of it and maybe some of the lows of that time? Because it's quite a challenging sort of time.
Yes, it was. And yeah, as you said, I ended up luckily on the Harrier after my flying training. And it was that's a bit of a weird one, actually, because I guess for you guys in the Fleet Air Arm, it was a very limited choice, wasn't it? If you're going fast jet, you're going to end up flying the Sea Harrier. Yeah. For us, there was a bit more choice. And you get towards the end of training and you can put your wish list in and, you know, I really want to go fly this jet. And weirdly, Harrier was not on the top of my list originally. But I think that's a factor of, you know, you hear all these sort of stories about, oh, the Harrier Force works so hard and, you know, they're really sort of aggressive types. And I didn't really feel that was me. And I felt like I maybe fitted the JAG mold better. But that said, I'm really pleased that I got sent to that aeroplane because, my word, what a phenomenal jet it was. Just so capable. And I swear the Harrier OCU was probably the most fun course or flying I've ever done. You know, you're there as a student in the middle of this clearing in a wood, you know, in a 20 million pound jet, just vertically taking off and landing. And you go, this is absolutely crazy. But then you actually get to find out how capable it is as an operational platform. And that set the tone for me for, you know, the first good sort of 6 years of my frontline career, really learning how to fight the Harrier as opposed to just fly it. And I guess with my timing, it was a bit of a rude awakening. I joined one squadron in 2001, and we were pretty much straight into, after about a year on the squadron, I guess I was night combat ready, so it must have been about 18 months, 2 years, suddenly starting to prep for Gulf War II. And yeah, it was like, blimey, we're actually going to take this jet to war. It's like, yeah, and it's that standard thing, isn't it? You join the military fully expecting that that's, you know, a possibility. But when it comes about, it's like, right, okay, everything you've learned is now for real. So not only doing that conflict, but then 2 years after getting back from that, we're in Afghanistan doing the same again. So it was a busy but very fulfilling part of my life, actually, you know, on the Harrier, especially becoming a weapons instructor on it, literally learning every single system, every single nut and bolt of all the weapon systems on it. But hugely enjoyable, very rewarding time, definitely.
Yeah, I'm, you know, unfortunately for me on the Sea Harrier, although it had obviously seen conflicts, but by the time I got there, there were no conflicts that the Sea Harrier was used. And although some of my mates did go off and fly the GR9, as you know, with the Joint Force Harrier, I didn't get a chance to go and do that for various
reasons.
I think
we had plenty of conflicts in the wardroom on board between 800 and 801 and our deployed squadrons. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Any scary moments that you can remember from your time flying the Harrier, either operationally or just flying the jet, Ben? Anything like that?
I'm sure there were plenty, most of which I've tried to forget about. To be honest, mate, as you well know, the Harrier is that sort of aircraft where it's very challenging to fly well, but it will properly bite you when you when you start losing concentration with it. And if I've had any scary moments with it's been entirely my own fault of just not staying as sharply focused as I would have wanted to. But luckily, touch wood, no, nothing major. Certainly a few.
In fact, a couple
on the boat. I think my first deck landing, actually, which is always quite a fraught affair because you know what it's like. You get to this thing and you've only got so much fuel and not really any diversion fuel to go somewhere out. You're pretty much committed. And I remember coming alongside, nicely positioned, you're doing your scan, you know, up and down the deck to the superstructure. And I was pretty much at the point of touching down. And I thought, I'm just a little bit off center. I'm just going to correct a little bit, and ended up starting to skip a little bit towards the edge of the deck. Huge handful of power to try and stop it. And anyway, plonked it down on the deck and thought clearly I was a hero for doing so. And only found out later that I'd blown in one of the side windows, one of the portholes on the lower on the deck lower down. I was like, oh, blimey. Well, yeah, that's probably a first, isn't it, for a deck landing? But no, I don't think, I mean, yeah, we know plenty of others who've had mishaps on the jet through either their fault or largely not their fault. But touch wood, I think I was pretty lucky, thankfully.
Too talented, you see, Ben. No, that's
hardly. Better to be lucky than good.
Indeed it is, yeah, never trade luck for ability. But somehow, being a sort of average pilot that you were, Ben, you then found yourself swapping your green flying suit for a red flying suit. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit more about that moment.
Sure. Well, again, a bit like joining the Harrier, that was definitely not on my radar, joining the Reds. And like I said, I'd done the second Gulf War. I'd done two tours in Afghanistan as the weapons instructor on our squadron. And so my focus was very much operational. Yeah, it was how to weaponeer the jet most effectively, how to get the squadron on a war footing to be able to do its job. And the thought of sticking a red flying suit and doing display flying was about as far away from my mind as I could think, probably about a year before I joined. But you get, I think everybody does, you kind of get to the stage where you've done everything that you can do on the jet, you know, you're experienced, you've got all the qualifications, and you do almost hit this sort of glass ceiling in terms of, well, I've done everything that I can do on it now. And that's the point where, you know, you start looking for the next challenge, I guess. And that's pretty much characterized my flying career all the way through, really. As you get to that point, you start literally scanning around. What is there to do next? What's the next big challenge? And I had a few friends who were flying on the Red Arrows at the time. And I think I met up with them socially, and you know, you start those conversations. You know, what is it actually like? And it soon became apparent that certainly as a flying challenge, but also as a teamwork challenge, they said there is nothing to compare with this. It is a whole new level. And we think you really enjoy it. So, yeah, I put an application in. At the time, they probably had about sort of 40, 45 odd applications for two or three slots. So I had absolutely no expectation of getting in. And I don't think most people did. It was almost a rite of passage. You sort of applied once, you went through the selection process if you were lucky enough to get shortlisted, fully expecting not to get in, but that would give you the experience to maybe come back and be competitive the second time round. And I think it was probably that attitude or that frame of mind which actually helped me, because I didn't put myself under too much pressure. I knew it was almost a sort of warm up, if you like, to the next year's application. And so I didn't, when I say I don't try too hard, I didn't try overly hard to be somebody that I wasn't. I just rocked up and enjoyed the selection process for what it was. And was lucky enough to get in. So yes, a year on from saying no, wearing a red flying suit doesn't interest me, there I was putting it on for the first time. And I have to say, yeah, yet again, it was the right decision, because that led to 5 years of some pretty phenomenal and challenging flying.
So it wasn't something you necessarily always dreamt of, because I remember being a kid, you know, seeing flying displays. Not that I ever physically remember going, I really want to be a Red Arrows pilot one day, because obviously I wasn't talented enough or good-looking enough to do that role. But it wasn't something you thought of from being a little kid going, you know, I will definitely do this one day if I have the opportunity.
Weirdly, I'd obviously seen the Red Arrows as a kid, and, you know, like you and I'm sure loads of others, it is one of the things that inspires you to go to an air show and look up in the sky and go, yeah, I really want to do that. Weirdly, when I was a kid, most of my focus was on Second World War aeroplanes. And maybe it's because I had two grandfathers who were pilots in the Second World War and flew those sort of aeroplanes. And that weirdly was where my focus was. So I should have ended up on the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, I think, but given where the interest started. But I think it's one of those things that when you start to fly and you start to realise the complexities and the sort of skills involved, that's when you can really appreciate the skill of what they do. It's one of those great things where to the average sort of spectator, it looks very impressive. But then the more you become a pilot and the more experience you get, the more impressive it becomes, because you realise actually what's involved. Yeah. So I think that's where the challenge of, or the desire to challenge myself in doing that came from. It was like, actually, yes, if I could do this well, then that would be a real challenge.
Yeah, I mean, all my Air Force mates, including you, I'm sure will banter me, but I would have loved to have had a go at doing it, just for those reasons. And in fact, I was lucky enough to be able to witness some of the flying, some of the briefing, the debriefing, when Squadron Leader Martin Pert, I think he's Wing Commander now, Perty, was the boss. And I went and watched it and genuinely blown away. And actually, there were some really interesting crossovers between the way that the Reds did the briefing and the debriefing and what I do in the commercial aviation world now. It's very different to what I remember from the standard military frontline type briefing.
Mm. Yeah.
But I was absolutely blown away by it, to be honest with you. And in fact, I chatted to Perty on one of the early episodes of the For Flying Out Loud podcast, and we're chatting about his time going across, leading the team across the pond as well, which brings another level which was, you know, taking a single engine aircraft, a small aircraft, all the way across the ocean like that was pretty amazing. And then leading a team. But one of the things I didn't get to chat to Perty much about, Ben, was how you actually go from being a team member to being Red One. How does that process of selection happen? As you put yourself forward, does someone have a quiet word with you over a beer? How does that sort of process work? And was that something that you really aspired to?
Yet again, at the time, it wasn't. But the process I went through, well, the normal process of being a Red Arrows pilot and then going on to become a leader is pretty well scripted. You do 3 years on the team as a team member, and even within that 3 years, it's one of the, you know, you're joining a fairly select group of pilots. You know, nine display pilots on a team. Even within those nine pilots, there's competition, and there's, you know, yeah. You join as a wingman in your first year, then everybody wants to be the synchro, you know, the synchro pair. Everybody wants to be the synchro leader. You know, you're constantly battling to, even within a team of nine, to be, achieve the biggest challenge out of that. And I was lucky enough to end up in my third year as the synchro leader. Normally, at that point, you would leave the team. You'd go back to either your frontline jet or to a staff tour. And at some point in the future, having achieved the prerequisite qualification, which was being a Red Arrows pilot for 3 years, then you could get selected to be the leader. With me, it ended up happening slightly differently. I was still on the team in my third year when the current boss at the time, Jace Hawker, came up to me and said, listen, they're starting the trawl for the next leader after Jace left. He said normally it would go to somebody who's been out for a while and come back in, but I'm minded to put your name forward. How do you feel about that? And I must admit, at the time, it was, and this is probably what a lot of people don't recognise here. A lot of people see the Red Arrows at air shows and, you know, strolling around in their red flying suit with their shades on, looking very cool. That is a part of the job, but as a job, it is knackering. I mean, you're just doing so much. I mean, the flying is hard work. It's physically challenging. You're doing, anywhere between two displays and two transits a day. You know, the long days. You've got all the public engagement, and then everything else that goes with it. It's people liken it to you're jumping on a roller coaster and you don't get off until 3 years later. So it's a big. Takes a big toll on your life. And at the time I was thinking, blimey, okay, well, I'm just coming to the end of my 3 years. I could probably really do with a rest. But equally, that's an opportunity that doesn't come around very often. So clearly I said, yep, chuck my name into the hat. But in terms of, to answer your question, in terms of what actually happens in terms of the process, I don't really know. I wasn't a party to it. I guess because I was on the team at the time and knew the current chain of command, or they knew me, that there wasn't really the need for a formal interview. So the next thing I knew later on that year was, yes, you've been selected to be the next boss. Wow. Which, like I said, that was not the normal way of doing things. And partly the reason for that, or for leaving the team and going to another job, is that you pick up some command experience, some staff college experience, or sort of desk officer experience, that sort of thing, to bring back to the team leader role. But I just rolled straight into another 2 years of leader. So I did sort of 5 years back to back, which was quite hard work. But I think the biggest challenge with that for me was, and certainly the biggest leadership challenge was, clearly I knew the guys on the team at the time, at the end of my third year, very much as a peer group. You know, they were They were your mates. They were your fellow pilots. You went to the bar, you drank with them, you socialised with them. And then suddenly, literally overnight, you had to transition into this role where you're now the leader, the commanding officer. And it's a very different dynamic. Now, luckily, I had a good team at the time who respected that change had to happen. But it wasn't an easy one to pick up, I must admit. Previously, the day before, you were part of the banter. Now you had to sort of almost step away a little bit. So, yeah, that was an interesting challenge to overcome. But I was glad I took the opportunity.
Yeah, it's something I chatted to Pertie about, actually, was this responsibility and where that line is between being a team member, because you're still a team member even if you're leading it. Obviously, a leader's still part of a team, aren't they? But they've just got a different role.
Yeah.
But it must be a very finely balanced role to play. And I guess for the general public, they just see the jets flying around. They think, well, team leader's leading them around. But that whole process that's happening in the background for that one sort of, 30-minute display is a much bigger event. So I can imagine, and a leadership is such a huge topic and everyone's got their own individual leadership styles. So I can imagine that must have been a really tough transition, but presumably one that you really enjoyed as well.
I did. And even the airborne leading was very, very different to anything we've done before. So aside from leading the squadron or the wider team of engineers and support staff, even the flying was something I'd never really experienced before. And that was a huge responsibility as well, because whereas before you were one of the eight wingmen, avidly staring at the leader, at the boss, ignoring everything else around you, but just taking all your cues, just trusting that he's going to put the formation in the right place at the right height over the right piece of ground and not fly you into any weather or any other hazard. Now that responsibility is lying with you. And of course, it's the sort of thing, because you've got so many aeroplanes around you, and I'm sure you've had this flying an aeroplane before, but you get the lineup slightly wrong and you go, oh, right, I'm just going to roll to the right and pull a little bit right. Now I'm properly. You can't do that with eight jets, in close formation around you. It has to be all very smooth, very considered. And so that was a big challenge or an exciting challenge, getting used to that style of flying. But equally, the rewards when you put the display exactly where you want it, with 20 knots of wind coming from the other direction, with a load of hazards around and a load of other factors coming into play, was massively, massively rewarding as the leader.
Anyone that's flown formation, anyone that's flown military formation, will know that leading a formation, even if it's just one other aircraft, and I think the most I ever led was three other aircraft, it is really hard, because as you've just described so eloquently, far better than I would, Ben, you're thinking about so much other stuff and you can't just do what you'd normally do. So you almost have to think several steps ahead. So I can't imagine what it's like having to do that with eight jets and do it to such specific timing and circumstances.
Yeah. And the other weird thing about certainly flying with the Red Arrows, and if a general member of the general public could listen in or understand the thought processes going on within the formation, it would be really quite interesting, because of course everybody thinks you're concentrating 100% on flying the aeroplane next to the leader, and clearly that does take a lot of capacity. But probably, do you know what? I would say 20 to 30% of the capacity of a fully trained Red Arrow pilot is on the show that they're flying. The other 70% of the capacity is thinking ahead to the what ifs. You've got one guy on the radio to a different radio frequency to some radar service. We might be tracking another aircraft that's getting close to the display area. So you're in the middle of a loop or a twist or a maneuver, trying to mentally plot where 030 at 5 miles is for a stranger aircraft coming towards the display, trying to assess where it is, trying to make sure that if it's looking like a threat, you either call off the display or pause. All of that is going on whilst the public's seeing red, white and blue smoke coming out the back. And of course the other big factor is you need to stay on top of any what ifs that might happen. And it's a colloquial military term, isn't it, the what if? But what if Red 3 hit a bird at the bottom of the loop and has to pull out the formation? Is it okay? And for each of those eventualities, we have a loser plot whereby with the eight jets remaining, we can rejig the formations. The radio calls change, the smoke colours change, everybody's position and moves change. And everybody has to know that and be able to switch into it instinctively. So we have a loser plot, we have an RT plot, which if number three did have to pull out, then number five would shuffle up into number three slot, he would put red instead of blue, and if it's that maneuver next, it's not called that formation, it's called something else, and the radio calls work differently. So probably 70% of your capacity is spent thinking, right, okay, if I have to switch to that, what am I going to do? And when it does, it needs to look seamless, and more importantly, be safe as well. That's the bit nobody sees. Everybody sees red, white, and blue smoke, and it looks very impressive, but there's a lot more to it behind the scenes.
I'm definitely getting back to that bit where I was saying I wasn't talented enough. I feel maxed out just listening to you. But I do remember, I think you were the boss actually when I was flying my glider around at Derbyshire and Lancashire Gliding Club, and you very kindly flew over the airfield. I think it was you was the boss then. One of the guys called up and just on the radio there, the little handheld radio I had at the gliding club, and said, hey, Campbell, it's the Red Arrows. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Hello. And I was blown away by the fact that you were displaying at Chatsworth Country House, which was an incredible display, actually, because it's sort of set in the hills of Derbyshire and watching.
It's a great sight.
Always blown away by watching the Red Arrows, but this particular display at that location, I was like, wow, especially when you're on the ground and you're seeing these jets, literally sort of treetop height. And then for you guys to fly over the gliding club, we were all massively grateful. And it was sort of a little mini detour off your transit home, but it was awesome. So thanks again for that, Ben. Indeed. So there were some pretty sort of dark times that happened during your time on the team, Ben, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to tell us a little bit about those times and how you personally dealt with that, and how you also led the team through those times, because it was a very challenging.
It was, and nobody wants it to happen. Unfortunately, in the world of aviation, it's an eventuality that can happen, and unfortunately, it does happen quite often for us on the team at the time. And I always remember when Jace handed the squadron over to me, and bear in mind, I hadn't had that break to go and get some more experience elsewhere. But he said to me, he said, get your feet under the table and hope nothing bad happens. I was like, okay, thanks very much, mate. Off we go. But in my first year of leading, we're out in Crete doing the spring workup when Lingy and Monty clipped. They were the synchro pair at the time, clipped wings and ended up with Lingy ejecting. Thankfully, he was fine in the end, but obviously suffered some injuries, and more importantly, wasn't able to take part in the display that year. And that, for me, that was the first realization that actually, this whole world of command and leadership is it's not a given. That comes with a huge amount of responsibility. And getting the team back on track after that accident, we had to bring in a previous synchro leader very, very late on in the workup. It all felt very non-standard in terms of the Red Arrows workup of normal years. But we got it back on track and delivered. And I genuinely thought, well, that's my incident, if you like, to have to deal with as a leader. And then very tragically, the following year in 2011 at Bournemouth, we completed the display, actually. It was a brilliant display. We were just literally on the run back into Bournemouth to land, and Red 4 Eggman blacked out on the break and ended up crashing his jet into the fields and was unfortunately killed. I can literally remember it clearly, understandably, to the day, every second of pretty much when that happened, to getting the jets back on the ground, and then everything that happened after that was, again, clearly a massive challenge to overcome, mainly because as an individual you're affected by it, but so are so many others, and therefore you do have that responsibility as a leader to try and gather everything around. But I guess I was lucky in that not only did the team pull together very well, our chain of command did as well, and gave us every support that we needed to try and get the team back on track. Not only from the very sort of day that it happened, but obviously then in the coming weeks when we're trying to A, deal with the loss of John, with the loss of Eggman, but also B, trying to deal with, it's August, there is still a display season to be had. The pressure was very much on, well, let's just call it a day for this year. There's no point in trying to push to finish the season. But as the leader, I was very, and again, this is maybe having been on operations myself, I was very adamant that we as the Red Arrows were, you know, we're the frontispiece of the Air Force and indeed the Armed Forces. We represent the excellence of the Armed Forces and of the Air Force and everybody who serves in it. And we have loads of people on operations day in, day out, who don't have the chance just to go, do you know what, let's call it a day, let's just pack our bags and go home. And certainly whilst the Afghanistan campaign was still going, lots of people were getting killed and their comrades were having to deal with that and carry on and do the job. And I was very adamant that we reflected that. Clearly we had to keep it safe, but I certainly wasn't going to throw in the towel just because that was the easiest thing to do. So we did get the team back on track. It then became a huge leadership challenge because people deal with events like that in different ways. Some people are able to very easily compartmentalize it and go, right, it's tragic, it's affecting me really badly, but I'm just going to lock it in a box, and when I jump in the jet, then we go flying. Others don't. Others react initially very badly and then later on very well. Some the other way around. They can cope with it very well to start with, but then it starts affecting them later on. And you've got 8 pilots and 100 odd engineers who are all suffering some form of the effects of bereavement at some point and the associated pressures with that, and trying to form all of that into a cohesive mould where you can go out and do the job safely was a huge challenge. I had probably 2 or 3 pilots who were able just to crack on with the job with no issues. Most of the others, to some extent, clearly and understandably, were affected at various stages. But you can only go at the pace of the slowest person, and that was the challenge. And I'm proud to say we did get back on track, and we did most of the rest of the season. We got to a point towards the end where a few people were coming or becoming affected to the point where we were going, do you know what? Now is the time to actually draw stumps on this season. So we always remember this. After John died, we checked him in on the radio every time, even though there were only 8 jets.
I didn't know that. That's nice.
And for those who don't know, yeah, we do a radio check-in at the beginning of each sortie, and it started by red 1 and then cascades through red 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Even though he wasn't there, we checked him in every time. You end up being so close-knit as a team like the Red Arrows that whilst any loss or death affects you, certainly on a team like that, it's magnitudes higher. So having to deal with that, both as individuals and collectively a team, was a massive challenge. And yeah, clearly that was a challenge I think we dealt with well, but it's clearly certainly one that I wouldn't want to have to deal with again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to give us that insight to, very sad event, but obviously some real strength that came out of it as well. I know that John's wife, Emma, has gone on with the Egging Trust, which is doing great work with young people as well. So that's really, really great to see. And a lot of stuff echoed with me there. Not for this, obviously I wasn't on the Red Arrows, but I'm sure you're aware, Ben, and I spoke about it in my first episode, the loss of an instructor. My instructor that I just outbriefed 5 minutes earlier, and I was the first to the instructor who'd ejected, and unfortunately had an unsuccessful ejection. But the thing with that event was it was me, 2 other students, one of which had ejected out of the 2-seat Harrier with Jack, and me and another student, and we were on detachment at Wittering, so away from our home base. And because I think it was detached really from the main squadron, no one else witnessed what I witnessed. And at the time, I genuinely didn't feel supported, and I didn't deal with it well at all, I don't think. I carried on flying, and my flying generally was okay. But then having had an engine failure a few months later, and then my canopy blow up and stop the engine 3 months after that, all in the space of 1 year, I think now, speaking to friends in the forces, things have moved on a bit. But I think you had that cohesive unit. I didn't feel like I had that at the time. It still affects me, I would say, for sure, if I think about it. Mm. But yeah, I take my hats off to you guys for carrying on and doing that. And, you know, Best of British still going. But yeah, I'm sure the memory of John lives on very firmly.
It does. And yeah. as you quite rightly said, his wife Emma and the John Egging Trust that she set up in his memory of, I mean, that is a properly appropriate legacy for John, the stuff that they've done. But it is really difficult. Like you said, things have moved on, and I think, you know, the understanding of, you know, sort of PTSD and all its various forms and trying to cope with those sort of issues is much better understood now. I'm a little bit the same, mate. It's sort of over 10 years ago now. I don't think I properly sort of processed it in the right way, partly because just the time and the situation you're in. And I'm sure a lot of people haven't either, but, you know, that's part of the factor of life. But I think you mentioned it, it's that sort of Best of British stiff upper lip, isn't it? That, yes, it's a very admirable trait, but it can be quite a dangerous one as well, in terms of just 100%. bottling things up. So, we were lucky. We had a bit of sort of psychological support, if you like, but whether some guys viewed that as a bit of a, you know, okay, well, we'll just go through the process, or whether it was actually useful or not, who knows? Yeah. But it's a sad part of aviation and performing aeroplanes to a high level like that, is that those things can happen.
Absolutely. Do you know, it's one of the real positives that's come out of me talking about my experience of that event, was that a former colleague of mine contacted me, having heard about it on the podcast 20 years later, and we hadn't always seen eye to eye, and I'm sure he's listening to this podcast because he tends to listen to a lot of them. But he phoned me up and said, it's 20 years too late, but I think I owe you an apology for not supporting you more. Which I genuinely appreciated. So if you're listening, I won't give his name out, but thanks for that, mate. I really did appreciate it. Towards the end of that time, though, Ben, that was pretty much towards the end of your time on the Red Arrows, and towards the end of your... so that's around 2011 time, and towards the end of your time in the Royal Air Force. So I think in about 2013, you ended up moving out of the Royal Air Force. How did that feel? Did it feel to you like that was the right time, or did it feel like things were coming to an end too soon?
No, it was definitely the right time for me. It was a natural point in my my commission. I'd done my 16 years, reached my 38 point. I'd moved straight from the Red Arrows to a two-year staff tour in the Ministry of Defence down in London. I think that was probably enough for me to go, yes, my time here is done. It wasn't helped by the fact that, there was clearly, after John's death and Sean Cunningham's accident, a short while afterwards, there were inquests and coroner's inquiries and the various things, and that was pretty draining. And I think for me, whilst I said we were well supported at the time, I started to get the feeling that maybe not so much towards the end of that. So it was a fairly easy decision for me to go, do you know what, the time is right to move on. And I ended up joining Lockheed Martin for an interesting project sort of overseas, and did about 3 years with them. And it was certainly towards the beginning of that I was thinking I'm really missing the flying again now. I was lucky enough to be invited to fly a Hunter, actually, a 1950s Hawker Hunter, for a privately owned aircraft by a chap who wanted me to display at Bournemouth, which was quite poignant for obvious reasons. So I did a bit of that, and that was enough to go, I just really need to get back into flying. So I ended up doing some part-time flying with the Blades aerobatic team up at Sywell in Northamptonshire, and then very quickly started to look at the next challenge on the horizon, which was air race, which was an interesting one, and yet again another one that hadn't really crossed my horizons much before, other than I think for one of the Red Arrows end of season guest nights, we had Paul Bonham, who I can't remember which year it was actually, but he'd just won the world championship in that year. And we had him along as a guest, and I remember standing outside on the steps of College Hall at about 3 o'clock in the morning, sharing a beer, sort of chatting about, chatting war stories as we pilots do, and he was explaining a lot about what happened in the Aeris, and that really, I'd never, other than that first PA 38 Tomahawk that you and I flew way back in the day, and maybe the Bulldog on a university
airplane. I haven't flown a light aircraft.
Piston engine aeroplane. I hadn't even touched for sort of 20 years.
Well, I saw
years,
you on Facebook, you know, the wonderful world of Facebook that only old people seem to use these days. Everyone's on the Insta these days. There'll be something else soon, I'm sure. But I remember seeing you, some in-cockpit footage, and I don't think it was in a Blades aircraft. It must have just predated joining the Blades. And I thought, what is he up to now? I didn't know what was going on. And you would sort of, it was just a selfie cam in this aerobatic aircraft. So obviously that was the start of your journey into flying these aircraft.
Back to basics, back to piston engine aeroplanes. That was a lot of fun. I guess the Red Bull Aeris in itself was a phenomenal sort of spectacle. And again, it was one that I had no idea how you got into, especially as an ex-military fast jet pilot. You know, a lot of these guys who participate in the Red Bull Aeris are sort of at the top of their tree in terms of competition aerobatics, you know, top 50 in the world of the unlimited class, this, that. You know, you had to have been doing that for years to get that good. And I literally had no time on these aeroplanes at all. But again, Paul Bonham was very kind enough to say, he was like, mate, if you can lead 9 jets around the crappy UK weather and still do the displays that you can probably miss a few pylons. So he sort of pushed me in the right direction. And before I knew it, I was sort of over in Salzburg having what I thought was a look around the setup there, and then got an offer to attend a training camp and a qualification camp thereafter, which was slightly scary because I literally had probably about 30 or 40 hours on the extra 300 at the time, trying to hold my own in there against these other guys. But no, that started that journey. And I think I said it earlier on in the podcast, it was yet another example of, right, I've done 5 years on the Reds. I feel like I've done that now. What's the next challenge? What is there out there still that could be incredibly exciting flying wise? And Red Bull Aeris fitted that bill absolutely perfectly. And yeah, so I joined the Challenger class for 2016. So I did the 16 and the 17 season as a Challenger pilot. And that's designed as a sort of feeder series, if you like, for what they called the Masterclass, which was, you know, the top tier teams and pilots. The top tier, the Masterclass, you obviously have a team around you. You've got your technicians, your analysts, your team coordinator. Yeah, the Challenger was designed to take all of that away from you and just so that you hopped in an airplane and went flying.
And is it the same aircraft, or is it slightly not derated?
At the time they flew the extra 300 in the extra 330 in the Challenger class, whereas most of the guys in the Master class were flying a much more agile sort of edge 540 or the MXS. It was a step change down in performance, but you're still racing very close to the ground through pylons, sort of pretty much doing the same course.
I think it's an absolutely mad sport, isn't it?
I remember,
I think I saw the very first air race, believe it or not, in 2002 in Zeltweg in Austria. And I bumped into, I didn't know Paul, I think he's actually on my flight now, on my aircraft on the day job. And I think he's just got into gliding, actually, which is a bit weird because everyone knows how mad keen on gliding I am. But I met Paul, I think it was Steve Jones, Peter Bezinier, is that how you pronounce Peter's? Yeah. And I remember, they won't remember it at all because they're much more important people to talk to, but having a couple of beers and chatting about it and watching it, I thought, what the hell is this?
Yes.
And I'm glad he called them pylons because I was going to call them posts.
I think back in the day, they weren't far off that. They were, I think it was a very much, I think the early days were, the sport's come a long way since those early days, but yeah, they were pretty crazy courses they had set up in those early days.
So how do you progress from this Challenger Cup racing to the Masterclass, where you're racing these even higher performance? Because the extra 330 is a pretty high performance aircraft, but these later things. So how do you come to move into that next level?
They had, and you've mentioned a few of the characters, Steve Jones being one of them. Steve was looking after the Challenger class at the time. Very well respected and experienced, you know, ex race pilot himself. He obviously looks at the flying ability of everybody in the Challenger class, but it's a lot more than that. Like I said, the top tier teams, you're actually running a team. So it's suddenly now not just you, the pilot. It's how can you how can you effectively run your team and everything that goes with it, you know, the commercial side, the sponsorship, the engagement, the activation, all the rest of it.
So the pilots actually run the part of the team
generally
on the
do, but generally wow. most of them were the team owners. I think the attraction for us was that we looked at it alongside the Blades or from 2XL from a business opportunity to, you know, we've got the structure behind this. So I think that was an attractive option. But weirdly, the intent of the Challenger class, like I said, was to take all that stress away from you. And then you felt it when you went to the Masterclass. For me, it was weirdly the other way around. I found the Challenger class way more stressful because everything up to that point, certainly in the Air Force, you were used to having a team around you. Yeah, even as Red One, as the Red Arrows team leader, I've got another nine pilots around, 100 engineers. You're used to this big structure. Everybody knows their roles and responsibilities. You can just leave everybody relatively autonomously to get on with what they need to do in the knowledge that they're going to do. Suddenly you get to the Challenger class and it's like, it was just me on my own. It's like, this is the first time in my entire career I've just had to literally look after myself. And it was quite a weird experience. And again, when I go back to the backgrounds of most of the other guys, they're solo competition aerobatic, but that's their way of living. Yeah, they go on their own to a competition. They do all their, walking through the display in their head, they go out and they do it. And that's what they're used to. When I moved up to the Masterclass, it was a case of, suddenly I feel at home again. I've got my team around me. Everything feels normal again. Everybody knows their jobs. I can just, observe and steer the team and just crack on and do my job. I think a lot of the others who moved up then had to cope with those challenges of leading a team. For me, it was it was like, okay, it's just business as usual.
Familiar territory.
Yeah, absolutely.
It must have also been interesting because this is much lower level to what you're doing, obviously, Ben, but so probably a rubbish analogy, but I fly competition glider flights now, and I've only relatively recently got into it, racing up to 40 other aircraft around the sky, and the speed at altitude is obviously less relevant than when you're 10 feet off the deck like you guys do. But I do, there's some of them that have a crew looking after the pilot. The top pilots have a crew, to get the water, to sort their maps out, to go and plug stuff into their kit.
Haven't got a crew.
I'm not going to have a crew. No one likes me, and I'm not.
Mate, I'll come and be your crew. I'll do it for a weekend.
Oh, thanks, mate. Appreciate it. Thanks. But it does add this extra layer of pressure, and I just think it would be nice. But also, I'm guessing that you've gone from not really competitive flying. I mean, the military is, you spoke about the competition in the team who wants to be synchro lead, but you've not had this, I'm actually got to beat these other pilots. Was that something that you found it relatively easy to come to terms with?
No, not at all, weirdly, because exactly as you said, I'd never been in that competitive environment before in that way. I think we're all, by our very nature as ex-fast jet pilots, pretty competitive people. And certainly are in the other spheres of life, sports or whatever. So I'm used to competition in that sense. But no, this very focused, it's now motorsport. It's about teams competing to win and doing everything that you can do to maximise your performance. So that took a little bit of getting used to. And I think certainly for the first half of probably my first season in the Masterclass, I put a load of pressure on myself. Thinking, right, I'm experienced enough to be able to put all these things in play, but I don't quite know what they are yet, but I need to go out and experiment with them. Yeah, that standard sort of fast jet mentality of, I'm going to make this work. And it was weirdly counterproductive. And it was only towards the end of that first season that I actually sort of took a step back and go, do you know what? We're actually doing all right. Let's just chill out a bit. Let's enjoy the flying, enjoy the way that the team is working. That experience that we need to compete at the very highest levels will come because it's called experience and that takes a bit of time. And let's just trust in our processes and not try and reinvent the wheel every race because we think there might be a subtly better way of doing it. And that worked really well. And I think for the last two races in our first season, we ended up in the final four, the final round, if you like. And ended up finishing the season seventh overall out of 14 teams. Normally when you join the Masterclass, you expect to be sort of down in 14th place or 13th if you're lucky. And we finished seventh, which I think was a, at the time, a sort of record for a rookie team coming in. And that mentality was exactly the right way to go. And then when we went into 2019, our second season, it was very much a, okay, we're on a path. We know what we're doing. Let's just have confidence in that. And then the results will come. And we finished that season fourth, actually. So, we were definitely on an upward trajectory.
I'm just wondering where it's gone wrong for me here, Ben, listening to this.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. It was an interesting one to... In fact, that's exactly what it was. It was just interesting because I'd never really experienced that. It was just like, you know, you think after sort of 20-odd years of flying by that point, you've seen most of... or certainly had to deal with a lot of those sort of things yourself, but it's that standard adage, isn't it? You always keep learning. And I think the racing taught me more about, certainly more about myself, not necessarily the flying skills involved in it, but certainly how you prepare mentally and how you as a person actually operate.
If you're a pilot looking to give yourself the edge when it comes to getting your dream job on the flight deck, then it's time to get yourself a wingman. Flight Deck Wingman has already helped hundreds of pilots find success with their application and assessment services and will be proud to help you in its mission to do the same. Learn more about their industry, application and preparation services, including their new simulator assessment courses, by visiting them at flightdeckwingman.com or checking them out on social media.
Well, I'd like to talk quite a bit more about this sort of mental preparation and how you ready yourself for a race, both mentally and physically, because I find it super interesting, all that sort of performance side of it. But for the listeners that perhaps don't know a huge amount about the Red Bull Air Race, I don't know where they've been, by the way, but because it's so cool. But what's the sort of general concept of the race? Is it a timed event? Is it something else? Talk to us a bit about the concept.
Yeah, it's a timed event. It's not like Formula One where you can put 20 cars on a track and all have them wheel to wheel racing. It just doesn't work with aeroplanes, or generally tends to end up going badly wrong with aeroplanes. So it's a timed event, timed lap around a course, or two laps around a course made up of inflatable pylons. So these are sort of two conical sort of pylon gates about sort of 60, 70 feet high. Laid out, and of course can be over land, can be over water, in a way that generates some quite high g-forces, quite high speeds, and it's whoever's quickest over a lap, and it's literally that simple. I think one of the really interesting things about the Red Bull Air Race courses, though, is that everybody goes, well, that's the course, isn't it? You know, pylons are here, there. The course changes completely when the wind changes. And that's probably the bit that people don't fully...
Oh, well, the actual layout of the course changes.
No, just the way you have to fly.
Just the way you fly it.
Yeah, if it's a still, calm day, yeah, you can literally point from one gate to the next, and then fly through it, and then point to the next one, and then fly through it. You get a 25 knot wind from whatever direction, and then suddenly it's back to those Tomahawk days. And even though you're doing 200 knots, you still have to point into the wind to fly across the line on the ground. So now suddenly you're not pointing at the gate anymore, you're pointing at a bit one side of it, and this is all happening at super high speeds, and then you've got you're pulling a critical angle of attack on the aeroplane fairly close to the stall, so that's another 15 degrees of nose authority around the corner from where you're looking. To actually fly accurately is a bit of an art, and it's definitely... people talk about, I think they do in other well, I know they do in other motorsports, but this sort of flow state concept of, if you're thrashing the controls around trying to go as fast as you generally end up slower. I've certainly found it doesn't happen every race, but there's certainly been races where you enter that sort of, you get yourself completely in the right place mentally, through preparation and just. The sort of tools that you use, that it all feels like slow motion, and those are the times when you go quick. It's literally like that scene out of The Matrix where Keanu Reeves is sort of slowly arcing his, these bullets are slow motion. It's exactly like that. It's the weirdest feeling, but you just feel like you can you could pick up a book and sort of read it between one pile on the next.
You do, but I'm not sure that everyone. I find myself in my glider standing on the rudder pedals.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm about, you know, 500 feet off the ground, 200 miles away from home, trying to get back, and willing this thermal to lift me into the air, and I keep trying to tell myself relax, but I've not achieved it yet. I'm not sure I ever will, but
I didn't say it happened at every race. I've had my fair share of races where I've done exactly that. I've literally been bending the stick because I've been gripping it so hard, but those are the races where, you know, you thrash the aeroplane around, you hit pylons and you get penalties, and it's, you know,
what are the pylons made out of, and is there any risk that you will damage it? I mean, obviously if you fly straight into one with a propeller, you're probably going to damage something, but I've seen aircraft hit them, but
it's come along. Yeah, I've hit more than I can remember. It's come a long way since its early days. Back in the days, they even, you know, the material that they used and the air pressure that
Bouncy
was used
castle.
To inflate them was, yeah, it wasn't enough to keep the things upright. They had to sort of guy wire them with sort of wires and ropes and everything.
Oh, my God.
Blimey. But nowadays, it's a very different prospect. And you're right. So the bottom of the pylon, which is much wider than the top, it sort of narrows to a point, if you like. The bottom part, the pylon, is made of exactly that. It's like Bouncy Castle material, that sort of plasticky, waxy, quite thick stuff. But then as every stage, and there's about, I can't remember exactly, 15 sort of sections or whatever, as you go up, each section is started to be made of thinner, lighter material. So the stuff at the top is thinner than paper.
It's wow,
like
really?
Sort of, it's like sort of sail material, but it's under such high pressure. You know, they've got loads of air blurs and generators and everything powering these things that... that's what gives its rigidity, but it also means that even when you hit it with an aeroplane doing 200 knots, it's under such high pressure. And if you watch slow motion footage of it, of the leading edge of a wing clipping the pylon, actually the pylon splits and bursts ahead of the wing. So sometimes really? you can hit these things and not even know that you've hit them. If you hit them high up near the top, it's literally the first time you know you hit one is when you sort of flown a vertical turn, come back around the course three the other way, and he's like, one of the pylons, how the hell's that happened? And,
that's incredible, mate. But it's still pretty dangerous stuff, this, because you're flying, what, an average of how many feet above the ground?
40, 50 feet. And like I said, if you hit one lower down, then yes, it can be a different story, and, you know, guys have ended up with some sort of structural damage on aeroplanes from hitting it very low down. But no, it's surprisingly safe as long as you're not stupid with it.
And who designs the courses? Who's actually sort of thinking up the design, and does it change much for each race?
Yeah, it does. And yeah, under the old race series, Red Bull Air Race, and certainly will be under the new Air Race series that is starting up this year. They have a whole dedicated team of, you know, an aviation team who are designing tracks. They want to make them challenging. They want to make sure there's sort of vertical extent, vertical manoeuvres for the crowds. But then they want to also make it, you know, it's a balance between making it exciting for the crowds, challenging for the pilots, and having lots of options. It's really dull if everybody just flies around the course in exactly the same way. If you can design a course that, you know, has the potential at one end to either do a flat left turn or a oblique right turn or straight up over the top, so people are doing different things, then it makes it a lot
and
more.
And is that something new under this new Air Race series that differs from Red Bull?
It's very much similar mentality, but if you can get a course like that, it makes it, because like I said, the wind changes everything. So
yeah,
on a course where you were going flat left at the top end of the course might be the quickest way around the track on one day because the wind's coming from a certain direction. If the wind changes, then that could be the wrong tactic to use, and you need to go, you know, oblique right or straight up over the top or whatever it happens to be. The wind completely changes how you plan and fly for a track, and that's, you know, clearly you have to fly the aeroplane well. You have to maintain the energy, be nice and smooth on the controls, reduce the drag, all the good stuff. But actually, races are won and lost in the preparation and the planning, in my view.
And do you get to have a practice of the course before flying it for real?
Yeah, it's the same sort of format as Formula One. You know, you have three practice sessions and then a qualifying and then the race. The only difference is the practice sessions aren't an hour long. They're literally 5 minutes long. You get about two, three runs, if you're lucky, through the track.
Wow.
For FP1, 2 and 3. And then two runs through the track for qualifying, and then you're into the race. So you can do a whole race weekend or a whole race week, actually, and probably have only flown through the track about 8 minutes or so by the end of it. So yeah, so it's not long. So any mistakes or not getting on top of, you know, the aeroplane or the track early on definitely cost you.
So the incremental gains must be super small, and presumably you're flying the same aircraft. And is it now called the Challenger Cup, or is it called something different? The Masterclass. My apologies.
It will be called a different. It will have different names under the new series, but essentially the structure is the same. So under the Air Race World Championship, there's going to be an elite class and then a sort of aero GT class. But same concept. But yes, the aeroplanes they're not identical. They generally come from the same base model. Most like guys, like I said, use the Edge 540. One still uses the MXS. But there are certain items on the aeroplane that have to be sort of stock items, if you like, spec items. So the engine, the propeller, you cannot change for obvious reasons. You know, trying to soup up an engine and start nitroing it and, you know, sort of put stuff is not the safest thing to do. But equally, you're given a fair amount of free rein for anything else. So, you know, changing the aerodynamic, changing cowlings, canopies, turtle decks, winglets, fairings.
So this is totally like Formula One, isn't it? You've got all the same basis.
It's like Formula One, but without the budget. So it would be nice to produce a million sort of different carbon fibre end plates and parts and guide vanes and all this sort of stuff, but the reality is that costs quite a lot. And we're not quite in that league yet, but it does make you think about every possible bit that you could improve. It's a standard thing, isn't it? It's marginal gains. If you make enough of them, then you will do it. But it is very easy to get carried away with yourself. Go, I could put this bit of kit in here, and we could get rid of that and replace it with this. And like I said, as the team owner, watching the dollar signs mount up, and of course the weight as well. Weight's your enemy, and you don't want the aeroplane to be too heavy. And in fact, in my second season of Masterclass, I think our shopping list of new items that we wanted on the aeroplane was starting to mount up weight wise. And my technician Andy came up to me in frustration, going, "Right, you can have all this kit on the aeroplane, but you know, if you do, then we need to lose 8 kilos from somewhere else, and the only place we're going to lose it is from you." and it was like, and that's when you go, "Well, actually, if it's important, then do you know what? Yeah, we'll do it." And I lost 8 kilos in the space of 5 months to get ourselves to the to still be well under the weight limit, and we put the new kit in. But it's how far you're willing to go, isn't it? Yeah.
It's the nut behind the stick, that technical piece of equipment, i.e. the pilot, that makes the real difference to a lot of this stuff.
If you speak to my team, it's not. No, we're just the stick monkey. It's their bits of kit or their processes that make the difference. And do you know what? They're actually right. And that's, for me, that's the really rewarding thing about the air races. Again, unlike a big squadron, Air Force squadron or the Reds, which has loads of people, our team's really small. There's only sort of five people, one technician, two sort of analysts, tacticians, a team coordinator, a team, sort of PR comms. But so each one of their roles is now super, super important. Yeah. And I think what I've found really rewarding with the race team stuff is, I think we're all control freaks at the end of the day. Just like, right, I think we should do it this way. I want to do it this way. But actually just going, well, do you know what? You guys are the experts now. So I'm going to defer to what you think is best. And I think as soon as you can do that, rather than just sort of keeping a tight grip of everything and running everything how you want to run it, which just suppresses people's enthusiasm. So if you go, right, okay, you run it how you think is best. And equally, when they do make a mistake or it doesn't work out, it's very easy to go, right, I told you, right, screw that, scrap that bit. We're going to go back to my way of doing it. It's just going, well, okay, I'm just going to ride it through, just let you absorb that, refine it, improve it, test it, run it again, and then it does work. Then that sense of achievement in that, and suddenly your team cohesion and will to develop and win after that becomes that much stronger. So that's certainly the bit I found most rewarding out of the racing.
It's that leadership again, though, isn't it? I've found, and I'm not always very good at this because we're control freaks, like you say, but the moment you trust team members to do a job and they do it, then that team is so much more successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you can get that level of trust, you know, if somebody makes a mistake, and I remember a classic in Budapest, I think, where it was all pretty rushed. But anyway, we went into qualifying with no smoke in the aeroplane, which, yeah, it's the margins are so tight, and that's a 1 second penalty before you even start going into the track. And I knew exactly what had happened, but yeah, it's like, okay, well, it's a mistake. Just put it behind me instead. In fact, I think I got so angry, I think we posted one of our best times and actually did quite well in qualifying despite the 1 second penalty. But
it was intentional on behalf of the team.
Since then, they've always joked that the way to make you fly faster is to do something wrong with the aeroplane, and it will put you in a rage and you know, make you. But the point was, yeah, we sort of landed. You didn't even have to say anything to you. You totally knew what had happened. Was mortified. There's no point in bawling somebody out for, because it's that trust thing. And, you know, he was trusted to do it. He knew exactly what had happened. And then and it never happened again. And his will to just prove that he was, you know, able to do the job even better was that much greater. So,
and are all these team members part of the Blades as well?
They're weirdly not, actually. No, Andy's German. Lives over near Stuttgart. Neil's in New Zealand now. No, we've got a spattering from all around. It's kind of strange because for those disciplines, they're actually very different disciplines to what we have and need on the Blades. Neil's a software sort of wizard, writes all his own code to develop these great analytical tools. We don't need that on the aerobatic team. Andy's a genius technician with the aeroplane, but yeah, we don't need that on the Blades. We've got so it's a different skill set. So yes, even though we're called the Blades racing team, it's actually a different crew apart from me.
Talking of the Blades, until recently, I believe, because I think Kirsty's moved on now, hasn't she? But you had a husband wife combo flying on the Blades aerobatic team with your wife being Kirsty.
So yes,
did that create any interesting dynamics?
Caused a few childcare issues. It's like, right, who's we're down in Bournemouth. Who's picking the boy up? It was fun. Yeah, we both really enjoyed the flying. It was definitely more of a logistical challenge than anything else. But I mean, Kirsty's done some fantastic stuff and did and still is a great sort of advocate for getting young people and certainly young women into aviation and promoting STEM and all the various facets that she believes she was lucky enough to be able to get into the Air Force and into flying, but not without struggles, but others aren't. So no, she's still very, very passionate about that, even when she's not flying on the Blades. To be honest, most people didn't even know that we were husband and wife. It was name.
Who's a better pilot, Ben?
I clearly can't answer this up. No.
Talking of sort of rivalry and better pilots, is there much rivalry between the Red Bull? The Air Race pilots. The new Air Race pilots are presumably the former Red Bull Air Race pilots. Is there much rivalry between you?
There clearly is. I mean, it's a competition, and everybody's out to win the world championship at the end of the day. But what I really like about it is that it's married up with we're all in this together. It's a brilliant sport. We're all very passionate about flying and about motorsports and about getting that message out. So it's a really nice mix. And I think if the sport, it's a bit like Formula One, isn't it? You get so big that you don't really get to mix with many of the other teams and everything. We're at that stage where that's very much still happening, and it's great to see as well. So if, for example, if one team had an inch, something went wrong that needed a fairly major, need to take an engine out, put a new one in, or something. It's not a case where the other teams are sort of going, oh, brilliant. They're causing themselves an outage. Yeah, everybody will pile around to the hangar, and everybody will help that team to get the aeroplane ready to go and do it. So there's definitely a really nice sense of camaraderie in the whole in the paddock, if you like, that we're all trying to put on this show, and we're all in it together. But yeah, when the canopy comes down and the visor comes down, then yeah, it's game on. Game Sorry, on. Mate, I'm gonna beat you.
Absolutely, and presumably, I mean, things can and do go wrong, and I'm guessing you may have had one or two scary moments, but presumably you all share that knowledge as well, because no one wants someone to have an accident and something worse to happen.
Yeah, it's very much so. I haven't had any particular scares with the Aeris yet, but we end up, yeah, you know, we go to some crazy places, you know, really short landing strips, bottom of quarries, you know, sides of docks, and yeah, you know, it's an eye opener, even coming from
the bottom of a quarry.
Yeah, in Russia, that's where we do the Russian race. Yeah, it's actually a little racetrack down there. But yeah, you're side slipping down the face of a, you know, sort of 100-foot quarry face and sticking it onto a very, very narrow strip. So it definitely opened my eyes to, blimey, we're operating these aeroplanes quite aggressively. But the attitude is very much that there is no point in learning all those experiences if you can't, you know, teach them and pass them on to others. Otherwise, you're just going to end up making the same mistake. So that's a very big part, an integral part of what was the Challenger series and what will be the new feeder series for air races. The guys literally sit down and over a day just watch all the videos, go through all of the previous occurrences, and be briefed by guys who have been there, seen there, done it. Because if we can do that, then we can hopefully prevent those from happening again. So yeah, it's very much a, yeah, share those experiences. And luckily, we are well served by, probably through the selection process really, but there are probably pilots out there who could be faster than we are, more aggressive, but that's only part and parcel of the type of mentality, yeah, and setup that you want. Yeah, yes, you've got to be pushing hard and aggressive on the course, but then when you can recognize a situation developing, you've got to have the nous to go, all right, enough's enough, I'm just going to pull out the track now. And the last thing they want is somebody who's going to be so, you know, get their teeth into it so much that they will quite happily pile into the ground because they want to pull a tighter turn or a smaller loop than everybody. So that's a big part of the sort of psychological mentality that they're looking for through pilots is, you know, you've got to perform, but you've got to do it safely in front of 800,000 people and not crash.
There's so many parallels. It's sort of combining all of that experience he had into this this type of flying. I mean, everything's obviously combined, all that experience to enable you to do this. Which do you prefer, Ben? Do you prefer flying fast jets or Red Bull Air Racing?
I get asked that question a lot, and the honest answer is my race plane. Even though it's 200 a bit knots, so it's way, way, way slower than a jet was, but just what you can do with it is phenomenal. And we're sort of pulling up to 12G in these races. It's just, and yeah, this thing can go from 0 to 14G in sort of 0.04 of a second. And it's just instantaneous.
How
performance.
Do you prepare your body for that sort of, you know, I mean, we both sat there and pulled G, sustained G, but nothing like that sort of G. I've never got, you know, never pulled more than 8G actually. But,
yeah, no, it's, and yeah, we're doing it without G suits as well. And it's, You're right. It's instantaneous G. It's only on for a few seconds, sort of over the vertical turning manoeuvres. But yeah, it's hard work. It's physically knackering. I again had to make a big change to how I went about life, and yeah, part of that losing a few kilos was, right, I need to get a dedicated personal trainer now and actually, you know, properly prepare for this. I was finding certainly in the Challenger classes that, you know, it's such demanding flying that you arrive at a race week on the Tuesday or whatever, and, you know, do a bit of test flying on the Wednesday, start practice on the Thursday, Friday, you know, you get to quality. By the time you got to the race on a Sunday, you're absolutely exhausted. It's like, you know, just even getting an aeroplane and flying a couple of laps was hard work because it's physically drained you. So that was a big part of my prep now, is to make sure that physically, fitness wise, yeah, that's not an issue. It's not just a weight thing. It's just, you know, we do a lot of training my neck, upper back, core, you know, because shoving 12G through your body with a helmet on and, you know, parachute and all the rest of it is quite hard on these 46-year-old bones at the moment. So
tell me about it. Yeah. You've not had the same lockdown experience as me, clearly, because I am definitely not in peak physical fitness.
Yeah. It definitely helps, and yeah, it's preventing injury as well, isn't it? Yeah, you know what it's like turning your head when you're pulling G. It doesn't take much to to tweak something. Yeah. So yeah, that is a big part of we've had a bit of a break through COVID and various other reasons of racing now, but you know, when we knew when racing was coming back, at least a year before that, it was like, right, we need to get properly on top of the fitness.
Good for you, and it's good to hear you saying you enjoy the air racing. I mean, for me, flying my glider actually is the best flying I've ever done.
It's weird,
I absolutely
isn't it?
Yeah. Love it. I was in the thermal with 42 other gliders at a recent competition. Just insane amount of aircraft and a very small bit of sky, but I absolutely
how do you avoid hitting each other?
Keeping a good lookout and trusting that someone's not going to do something stupid. But we'll have to go flying, and even get into a glider with a thermal with 10 other gliders will probably blow your mind a bit. What really stands out to me with all this, Ben, is I just feel so lucky to interview people like you, even though we go back a long way from all sorts of walks of life. It's really humbling, but also strikes me just how lucky we are to have had this career, because there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast that haven't had this opportunity yet. This is their absolute dream. So I think we're just so incredibly lucky.
We are, and I do that literally every day. I just do not take it for granted that we've been able to have these experiences. And like I said, I'm always looking for the next challenge, but I'm always extremely thankful that we've had the opportunities that we've had. But yeah, I think we're getting to that old knackered stage, mate, where I do want to start giving that back and helping other people to get into flying, or anything to do with aviation really, or just do something that they enjoy doing. I think we were what makes us extremely lucky, and I always remember this phrase, if somebody. If somebody could, or if you would pay to do the job that somebody pays you to do, then you found the right living. And I know 100%. A lot of people aren't lucky enough to be in that situation. We have been, and we should never take that for granted.
Thanks for that, Ben. Ben, I'm going to move to this section I call the Winging It section, which is just a bit of fun, a random question for you to answer. So are you ready for your Winging It question?
Fire away.
If you could be any person alive today, who would it be and why?
Ooh. I tell you, a person I have a lot of respect for, just because partly I think he's barking mad, but he's got exactly the mentality that I admire, is Ranulph Fiennes. I think his background and his tenacity and his just grit and just go, right, screw the world, I'm going to go and do these, mate. So, yeah, I've been lucky enough to hear him speak on a number of occasions, actually. But I think he's had a pretty phenomenal life.
No fingers to be able to go and...
Yeah, he voluntarily chopped them off himself. Yeah, that's true.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible guy. Yeah, great answer. I haven't heard of Ranulph Fiennes for a while. I remember him being on TV quite a bit with various things he was doing, but he must be getting quite old now. But incredible character, absolutely. Have you ever considered this Reno air racing, Ben? Have you ever thought about getting stuck into that?
It's never come up as an opportunity. It's clearly, it's an exciting form of air racing. I've never really had the in, really. I've never even actually seen it live. It does look pretty phenomenal. It's very different to the Red Bull Air Race. I think I'd love to get a go. Why not? Yeah, I'm up for anything. Can you
I just
think
those highly modified P51s are the most awesome things. The noise they make, but it's all too dangerous. And again, still not good enough or good looking enough. But what's next, Ben? Is there anything that we can see? Obviously, we've got the new Air Race series coming up, and I was interested to see that actually there was quite a lot of new tech in terms of green fuel. What do you think? What's next for you, and what do you think's next for the Air Race?
Yeah, I think this is a really exciting time to be not just in Air Race but aviation. In general, I think the new Air Race series is going to bring a lot of what Red Bull did very well in terms of the actual racing and the sporting sort of spectacle that brings, but very much with a focus on clean energy, sustainable aviation moving forward. So that is a key part of the approach and the messaging going forward. Looking at different biofuels, sustainable aviation fuels that we could and should be using, promote those to the wider aviation sector. There's going to be a lot of focus on STEM and trying to use the racing as a means to get young people into aviation and technology, and look into the future as well. I mean, what I think is really fascinating at the moment in the world of aviation is you know, the rise of electrification in aviation, it's not going to completely change all facets of aviation, but it certainly will change some. And the rise of sort of eVTOL is clearly going to be key as well. So I think that's really exciting. I think being in a position to race and promote that is really exciting. And I genuinely think in 10, 15 years' time, we're all going to be experiencing a very, very different way of moving around than we are at the moment. It's exciting times ahead, I think.
I was interviewing Richard Browning of Gravity Industries, the jet suit man, recently.
That's another way of moving around in a different manner, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But do you know what was interesting, though, listening to you and to Richard, and, you know, you've both gone into these super cool things. But he was saying, you know, it's a bit like climbing mountains there with all this stuff. You get to the top and you go, well, I'm here now. It's not really, you know, that isn't a great high when you're at the top. And you never sort of sit there and enjoy the moment and then go, you're always on to the next mountain and then the next mountain. Do you think that you'll ever find a time where you just sit back and go, do you know what? I'm happy now. I'm satisfied.
No, I don't think so, in all honesty. That's how I like to be. I get really sort of twitchy, and sort of if I've been sat around doing the same thing for too long, I do like I said, sort of doing something well and then looking for the next challenge and just keep pushing myself. I know, you know, things like flying with the Red Arrows were a huge privilege and it was a massive part of my life and a great experience. What I absolutely didn't want to do is to get to a later stage in my life, you know, kicking around in my slippers at the age of 70 going, all I'm remembered for, or all I feel is a big achievement in life, is flying with the Red Arrows. I didn't want that at all. And I'm lucky enough already to go, actually, there's loads of different aviation experiences, you know, flying a Harrier, you know, Red Arrows, air racing, whatever it happens to be, that I look back on equal sort of fondness in terms of memories and achievements. And that's how I want to keep going on. So, yeah, there's some exciting stuff on the horizon. Can't talk too much about it at the moment, but hopefully in our next chat we could. And that's the plan, really, is just keep looking ahead at the next challenge, the next opportunity, the next exciting cool thing to do, and just go out and do it. You only got one life, haven't you? We're going
to
live it.
Can't wait to hear about it. But we're almost at the end now. I'd like to sort of know, if you could say, what have you been most grateful for in life, what would you say?
Well, lots of things, really. I think the fact, you know, we're talking about health...
It is a big question. Yes, I appreciate that.
It's a philosophical now, isn't it? I guess to have my health and to be able to do all these... Do it. You know, we talked about being in a sort of privileged position to do this, and we are, especially when you look at a lot of the challenges facing the world at the moment. So it's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? Because, well, you're the same. You know, we've worked hard to get to where we are, but we've had a pretty big leg up along the way, and a lot of people don't.
Absolutely.
So I'm very grateful for that. Yeah. Very grateful for my health, kids, family. I think if COVID's taught us anything, then suddenly those things become hugely important, aren't they? So, and I think that was, certainly for me anyway, that was a good sort of reset. Yes, it's great fun jetting off around the world doing various things and lots of cool stuff. But actually, the important stuff is a bit closer to home.
100%. You know, it's interesting. I was watching a YouTube video, which I might reference in a later podcast episode, but that point that we've been really lucky and not really faced challenges. Everyone has challenges. Everyone, of course, they have challenges. But there's a video out there with some young people, and they're told to start a race, but they can only run if they've never had any of these problems. I don't know if you've seen the video.
Yes.
And he said, you know, so you can run if you've got a family that are still together, and some of the people run, some of the children don't, then you can run if you've, you know, never had, if you've been given enough financial backing to go and do something. And again, some people stand still. And it's when you see that you realise that actually people in life don't have the same opportunities, many of which are not their own fault. And I personally I try to inspire people. That's the whole aim of this podcast, actually, is to inspire people to think and try and dream better. But not everybody has the same helping hand. And in fact, far worse than that, a lot of people have even more things inhibiting them. So I would, hope that more people do more things to help more people and actually aren't so narrow-minded to say that, well, if you work hard enough, you can achieve anything, because actually that's not true for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a very glib statement, isn't it? No, you're absolutely right. Spot on.
Ben, if you could pass a message on to any of the listeners out there on the podcast, what would you like to say before we wind this up?
I think we're at that stage now, aren't we? We're breaking out of COVID, that life can begin again. So go out there and have some fun. Thank you for listening to our ramblings, and thank you, Scrabble, for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. Thinking about stuff and
it's been absolutely awesome. Yeah. Well, it's probably the biggest catch up we've had in quite some time. Right. Yeah, we've bumped into each other briefly, but Ben, thank you so much.
We should do it in another 20 years, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I think Knox will be 66. There's a scary thought. About 30 years, going back to our time on the Flying Scholarship, we'll be 76. So there, that's pretty scary, isn't it? But Ben, yeah, it's been awesome to talk to you. Wish you and the rest of the pilots and all the teams in the air race the very best. The Blades aerobatic team, obviously, for a really great season as well, hopefully coming out of this COVID pandemic. But thanks again so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.